Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What comes after the ceasefire? Will Israel look for a way to end the hostilities, or will it continue its war of annihilation? Also, next year, NATO turns 75 years old. Is the alliance seeking a creative way to induct Ukraine into NATO? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He is an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start out with George in Budapest. Okay, as we're speaking, gentlemen, the ceasefire is holding. The second day was a bit wobbly. There was some doubts into going into the night, but they made it through. So there's every reason to believe that this ceasefire, pause, exchange of captives will proceed. I don't think there's much doubt about that. It's what comes after. And I think that's really the big question. And there'll still be a lot of captives in Gaza. And there are a lot of military officials as well. Hamas is not going to give them up very easily. We've seen in the past, I think it was for one soldier, 1,000 prisoners from Israeli jails. So this whole process of exchange is far from over. And Netanyahu's government has made it very, very clear, with the blessing of the Biden administration, that hostilities will continue. So what, George, the day after this lull in the fighting, what happens?
That's a very good question.
I don't think anybody has exactly the answer. I'm asking you to kind of, you know, put on
your creative. That's right. I certainly don't have the answer. My feeling is that, given the very emotional response on the part of the Israelis to the hostage release, and there's obviously two more days of these releases to come, I think it's going to be very difficult to go back to the same mass bombing and destruction that was prevalent before the exchange, because I just don't think the Israeli public will stand it. And there are still some 200 hostages left. The Israelis want them released. I mean, they're very, very distressed about it. And there have already been, these mass demonstrations even yesterday in Israel demanding that the remaining hostages be released. So I tend to think that, yes, Israel will resume its bombing and its destructive campaign. But I think that it's going to gradually wind it down. I think that It's difficult for them for the government to sustain this public support. They're losing, if not completely lost, whatever international support that they had. Even the Biden administration is becoming exasperated with Israel. So I tend to think that it will gradually be wound down, and that there'll be more of these pauses and hostage exchanges down the road before finally some kind of a ceasefire is cobbled together. What then happens? I mean, that in itself is also very difficult to say.
Well, Martin, during all this, more and more Gaza is uninhabitable. It just, you can't live there. There's no infrastructure at all to sustain existence here. I think that the Israelis will with great fervor will continue the operation. Maybe less so on the ground, but certainly the bombing. Because Martin, one thing that's not only does October 7th mean a lot to a lot of people in Israel, fair enough, but having to have to negotiate with Hamas, this is really, really difficult for them, okay? And because when I mentioned earlier on the second day of the exchange, there was a hiccup here, and you know, and it was Hamas saying, you're not fulfilling the agreement, so you know, and that's infuriating. And I think that, you know, when this 4-day exercise comes to an end, I think the Israelis are going to have just as much fervor and anger and the demand for revenge. And whatever the cost, George, you're right. They don't have any international support now. So what? The Biden administration is behind us. That Thanksgiving speech that even Netanyahu gave, okay, basically whatever it takes. So I'm very pessimistic. Martin?
I'm also very pessimistic as well. I think Netanyahu will come back after the ceasefire with all guns blazing. I think he'll actually intensify the campaign to make his point. Look, there's a couple of issues here. First of all, his own support is dwindling rapidly. I wrote an opinion piece, I think, after 1 week, saying how long has Netanyahu got? I'm not patting myself on the back for my prescience, but I think he hasn't got long at home. I think it's an awful lot of Israelis are wondering, I've already said there's no way we're going to vote for this coalition again. And Netanyahu's own popularity has plummeted. So there's pressure on him at home. But I think internationally, it's the key. Internationally, there are too many Western leaders who, on the one hand, bang the drum and say, Israel has every right to defend itself. You know, but on the other hand, are looking at the numbers of people in London and in America and DC and around the world and thinking, how much longer have we got politically if we don't do something about this ceasefire? You know, so you have Spain and Belgium have already come out and really fiercely campaigned for a ceasefire and the immediate recognition, or more or less immediate recognition, of a Palestinian state. If one or two other EU member states join them, which I guess they will, I think that puts Netanyahu's campaign on a stopwatch. And he may well be thinking, look, we've done 7 weeks, something like that. Could we do another 7 or 8 weeks and get another 15,000 or so? It probably isn't 15,000, first of all. It may well be 30 or 40. We just don't know who's under the rubble, you know. But he's probably thinking he needs to intensify this because he thinks that he can bring Hamas to its knees and he can get that victory, that unconditional surrender. But another factor to this is that he wants to annihilate the entire population anyway.
Well, that's the point, Martin. And I throw it back to George here because, you know, Biden is saying, you know, he supports Israel's goal of eliminating Hamas. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's just code for eliminating the Palestinians, George.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The Biden administration has said what we will not accept. We will not accept reoccupation of Gaza by Israel. We will not accept ethnic cleansing.
But all of those things are happening.
Well, yes, it is happening, except that they mean it not on a permanent basis. And then ultimately, then what is Israel going to go on doing? I mean, yes, they can go on this pointless, destructive craze, but they're not going to succeed in driving out the Palestinian population. I mean, it's clear that Egypt is not going to go along with it. Jordan is not going to go along with it. The Biden administration isn't going to go along with it. So he can go on doing this, but the Israeli public, I think, is getting very wary of this. And after, you know, they're obviously very hostile towards Netanyahu. Yeah, he's politically, he's done. But they want the hostages back. I mean, at this stage, you know, their feeling is, okay, we've made our point, but we want the hostages back. And then the idea that we're just going to go on bombing and bombing, and then these people say, well, where are hostages? I just don't think that's going to happen. So, you know, this is the pattern of all these previous, what we call the sort of mowing the lawn exercises. You know, Israel pummels away. And then finally, when you know, they haven't really achieved anything very much, well, they call it a day and then just kick the can down the road for, you know, the next guy in.
Yeah, but Martin, qualitatively and quantitatively, this exercise of mowing the lawn is of a different magnitude. I mean, totally different magnitude. And as I've already mentioned, parts of the Gaza Strip now are completely uninhabitable. The cost, and then you have to remember the blockade is going to continue. So, I tend to think that there's this kind of messianic urge. Push that they want to destroy as much as possible. I mean, you might not be bombing them anymore, but there's no way to live, okay? And considering the Israelis have been very stingy about aid coming in, I think this is just an ethnic cleansing by different means. Martin?
But I don't think that can continue. The blockade of aid, I think that will be a huge political point. You know, Turkey, Iran, Qatar are countries that are really, really, really angry with Israel and Netanyahu, and they are literally frothing at the mouth. And Turkey has been having a number of meetings with Iran. You know, we can't mess with Turkey. You just can't mess with that size army, that disciplined army, you know, which is a NATO member. We can't afford to go down that road. But I think those countries will demand, when the dust settles, they will adopt Gaza. They will basically rebuild in a couple of years all of those apartment blocks, all those institutions, the roads, everything. And what will Israel do then? You know, I mean, I think the bigger question here, going back to the six weeks or 8 weeks, or can Netanyahu do another run that he's done? And I think that the clock is really ticking, and I think it will be countries like Qatar and Turkey who will actually put pressure on through back channels, the Biden administration and the EU and more EU member states, to say, look, enough is enough. Let us now build the two-state solution. We will come to Gaza and we will build it. And then, you know, we haven't got any situation therefore that Netanyahu can play with. Now he's pushed himself into a corner, you know. But the other thing is that Israel, I mean, a lot of humble Israelis are beginning to ask themselves, how do we continue after this? How do we function? We were an internationally plugged in country to the rest of the world, you know. How do we export our goods? How do we trade? There is so much anger out there. There is so much.
Fair enough, Martin J. But you know what? How many of these countries have cut diplomatic relations with Israel? Okay. Where is the oil embargo, as George has mentioned, in the past? Okay. There's a lot of anger, but I mean, when it comes to policy, I still think there's a lot of weakness, particularly in the Arab world. George, as we finish up this part of the program here, how does Biden move forward? I mean, he's running for re-election. We have 70% of young people polled do not like his foreign policy. I think that's obviously when in reference to Gaza, but I think to some extent with Ukraine as well. Is he permanently stained by this really adventurous foreign policy of his?
Well, I would like to think that's so, and that's probably so. But there is one caveat with that, is that, you know, if this come to an end, let's say within the next, let's say sometime within the next 2 months, it comes to an end. So that takes us through to January, you know, whenever we start with the primary season. You know, what does the Democratic Party do in those circumstances? Well, they do what they always do, which is, oh, my God, if you don't vote for Biden, the big, bad, horrible orange man is going to come in. You have to do everything you can to vote for Biden. And all those young people who are now protesting about Israel.
And the big orange man, we
can't allow Trump to come in.
The big orange man is an even bigger supporter, at least equal supporter of Israel as the Biden administration. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to George and change gears here. You and I have been musing about over the last few weeks on how NATO wants to become like Houdini. You know, they want to be magicians. They want to come up with creative ideas, okay? And obviously, I'm making reference to Ukraine. After all, next year is the 75th anniversary of the alliance. They're all very, very proud of themselves, even though it's completely failed to keep the peace in Europe, its primary mission. And we've heard of these different ideas that, you know, you don't have to recognize that Russia has territorial control over the Donbass, two other regions and Crimea. We'll just pretend they don't. OK, and you don't have to walk away from. We're just going to pretend. And then, you know, the old and tried and tiresome policy. How about a no-fly zone? Okay, as if that's like a new idea. Okay, I mean, grasping at straws. But as the alliance goes up to its 75th birthday, you know, most people retire before 75, George. And maybe you know the alliance ought to be thinking about that too. Okay, but they got to put some lipstick on this pig, George.
Yes, I think so. Well, the 75th birthday party that's coming up next July. I tend to think that NATO cannot do what it did in Vilnius last year, just to fob Ukraine off with, you know, another, you know, bunch of meaningless words.
And a pat on the head.
A pat on the head. They have to do something to say that, hey, you know, we have accomplished something in Ukraine. And that's why I think it's very significant that those, I mean, this is something we've discussed before, those two articles that appeared recently, you know, one by Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former NATO Secretary General, one by Admiral James Stavridis, the former Supreme Allied Commander. So those are the two most senior people in NATO, and they both said, well, we can do it. We can actually induct Ukraine into NATO, and then we just present Russia with a fait accompli. Are you ready to escalate and wage war against NATO? And Russia has, throughout this so-called special military operation, has shown great reluctance to extend the war in Ukraine to any NATO territory. So, you know, I tend to think that, you know, though, given the stature of these two authors, you have to think that this is a stalking horse. And where NATO made its previous mistake in 2008 is that it said it in public. We will bring Ukraine into NATO. That gave Russia time to prepare and act. So what if they're now thinking in terms of, well, we're not going to say it in public. We're just going to announce it, that this is done. We've gone it. We've been and gone and done. Ukraine is now in NATO, and there's nothing Russia can do about it. I'm not saying this will happen, but I do think that this is what they're thinking about
right now. That is a really playing the ultimate game of chicken, because Martin, okay, let's just say Brussels does that. You know, Stoltenberg, that's, you know, it's going to be his parting gift to the world. Does Russia necessarily have to recognize it? It may not, and it may continue its operations in Ukraine, while the rest of the alliance thinks Ukraine is a member. So I would throw it the other way. So do NATO countries want to actively get involved in a war against Russia? It cuts both ways. Go ahead, Mark.
There's just so many things wrong with it. You know, it's, yeah. when you think of these people, NATO, you know, acolytes, with the problem of Ukraine, it's rather like witnessing somebody standing over a sick dog beating it with a stick, you know, and the more the sick the dog gets, you know, the harder they beat it, hoping for a magical solution. That's really the Ukraine thing, miscalculation, layer upon layer. And this is just another one of those far-fetched ideas. You know, you've got to pity the NATO lot when they have their party in July. You know, what are they going to celebrate? That's the problem. You've got Ukraine, which is a spectacular failure, you know, and people are admitting it. It's not like people are being quiet. You know, a number of NATO leaders are actually alluding to this. Americans are saying, some of the most important people in the Washington swamp are saying, is this a war that we can win? And we, you know, we're old enough, the three of us are old enough to remember that was the rhetoric at the end of the Vietnam War. You know, it's not can we win it, is, you know, is it winnable on any level, any imaginable level? And of course it isn't. You know, I think there are a couple of points wrong with the former NATO Secretary General's idea, you know, that Ukraine can have sort of semi-membership, a half-baked membership of NATO. He actually said in an article I read that once that was set up, once Ukraine would have this sort of special status membership of NATO, Russia wouldn't dare invade at that point because they would be attacking a NATO member state.
Yeah, but they're already there.
I know, but I think that's fatally flawed. That's really fatally flawed, you know, because again, you know, it doesn't put the emphasis on Russia. It puts the emphasis then back again on the West and NATO states to do what if then Russia attacks. It'll be back on their foot, you know. Another point is that NATO is not an institution that does state building. And, you know, it's very difficult to have really criminally backward corrupt countries in it, you know, to set the level, to set the standards towards countries like Georgia, for example, who, you know, are aspiring to become a member state of NATO. So it doesn't do that. Unlike the EU that pretends it does that, NATO doesn't build democracy. And one of the big points, to join the NATO club, you're supposed to have a pretty clean slate on corruption and on levels of democracy. Even though at Vilnius, it was less reported that some countries offered you know, a get out of jail card for Zelensky. They would bypass that rule and allow him in. But I think the hardest bit to swallow of this is that in that document, in that proposal, there is a suggestion that those regions that you were talking about would just be handed back to Russia and forgotten about. And the problem with that, of course, is Zelensky himself. Zelensky has banged the fist on the table so hard and so long and said that is not negotiable. That throws up another question between now and July, is that if the NATO party is going to go ahead, could it go ahead without Zelensky? Is Zelensky the problem?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's exactly it, yeah, George. But I mean, going back to these NATO plans, that they're not thinking in terms of security. See, that's again, NATO isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, thinking in terms of collective security. What they're this magical thinking, and that's exactly what it is it increases insecurity for everybody involved. I mean, it's doing exactly the opposite of what it was designed to do, George.
Well, that's NATO's raison d'etre. We talked the other day about this border crisis that's just been manufactured out of thin air in Finland. You know, here is Finland, yeah. You know, no problems at all, 77 years. Now it's joined NATO, and lo and behold, there's a border crisis with Russia. So, you know, NATO, you know, it has to justify its existence, and therefore it has to continue to manufacture the crises that it then presents itself as the solution towards which.
Yeah.
Now, in this case of inducting Ukraine into NATO on the sly, it would probably go together with some kind of an armistice. And in other words, just let's stop fighting for the time being. So let's leave aside the stuff whether Russia will accept this, but if it goes together with that and say, we're not actually accepting that these territories are lost and that they're now part of Russia, we just will stop fighting for the time being, you know, a la, you know, Korea, you know, Vietnam, also, you know, at the time of the Geneva Conference in the 50s. And this is the way Americans often operate, which is, well, nothing is just settled. We'll leave it into the future. And then, of course, you know, NATO can start this whole thing up all over again.
Yeah, what appears to be in play here is that they just can't utter the words "we lost." Okay, so yes. Martin basically is just just enough to keep the lights on. Okay, I mean, just enough. You know, that's what whatever it takes means now is that we pay their bills, we keep the lights on, and we can keep up the rhetoric. But it's essentially accepting defeat, just not saying it, Martin.
But how long can that go on for? You know, I don't think for that much longer. I don't think we'll get to the party in July before a number of commentators, a number of member states will start saying, look, something has to be done. Something has to be done about Ukraine and quickly, because NATO itself has a credibility problem. You know, forget this nonsense that we heard, you know, at the beginning of the war that, you know, NATO has had a fresh shot of new life, you know, injected into it. The Ukraine war gave it a new identity, you know, following up from Macron's brain dead comment, I think, before that. You know, I don't buy that. I don't think that's at all the case. I think the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And if you are setting yourself up to be a huge international security operation, but you are afraid of firing one bullet and sending one man to the front line and just dodging and ducking every weaving through every possible diplomatic faux pas so that you don't go to war and that you just play the escalation card every now and again. And, you know, at some point, we're going to look for scapegoats, you know, between now and July. And Zelensky's probably the biggest scapegoat there is. He's having pressure put on him by some people in Congress to hold elections next year. He's saying, no, this is a wrong time for elections, you know. I mean, like Netanyahu, you know, there's a link there. Like Netanyahu, these are both leaders that know if they went to the polls today, they wouldn't win. So, you know, there is a certain, Zelensky is still the puppet of the Biden administration for as long as Biden decides. You know, there's this wonderful cartoon meme created on social media of Biden putting his hand on the shoulder of Zelensky, and Zelensky is looking up to him like a little boy saying, but you said until the end. And Biden says to him, this is the end. And I think we're going to reach that point between now and July. My 50 cents, my crate of Guinness or tray of bread pudding bet is that Zelensky is going to be edged out of power, I think, before those celebrations can go ahead.
Yeah, but then what is the value of NATO for Ukraine? I mean, if they so, you know, some magical way, George, they get in. So is the 52nd Airborne going to start bombing Russia? I mean, none of this makes any sense. Go ahead. Last 15 seconds. Go to you,
George. But the Biden administration has invested a great deal into this war. I don't think they're just going to let go of it. That's not the way the Americans operate. And Zelensky is a useful person there. You know, he's Jewish, as they keep reminding us. And so if you get rid of him, you no longer have the alibi about all the Nazis in Kiev. Say, hey, we have a Jewish president. So you don't have a Jewish president, then, you know, you suddenly
tokenism in American foreign policy. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.